Well, good morning. You're listening to WFERLP South Royalton, Royalton Community Radio, radio of the people, by the people, for the people. It's a Thursday for listening in live time. It's a beautiful late summer day outside. Looking forward to, I'm enjoying being in the studio, but I'm looking forward to being outside on my bike, outside of the studio shortly. But we've got an hour of environmental news and commentary for you coming up on Green Zine, and I thought we would play this little piece of music as we get ready. Peaches everywhere, and they're getting pretty ripe. I brought a couple with me today, and you can take it from there with the Allman Brothers Band. Henry on the line. He'll be joining us shortly here on Green Zine. But we do want to acknowledge the people that help us do this show for, we're well into our 11th year. They include Soloflect, and thank you, Rob, for your support. Soloflect in touch with the Imagine Zero Music Festival. We'll be talking a little bit about that, which is coming up on Saturday for you environmentalist music lovers, a combo deal out there. Building a Local Economy. Find out more about their activities at balevt.org. Royal Trail Works. Thank you, Tom Wells, for your ongoing support. Daniel Leibowitz, had a chance to ride bikes with him recently during our 11th annual Pedal Power to the People event. Upper Pass Beer Company, small farmhouse brewery at an undisclosed location in the hills of Tunbridge. First Branch Coffee Company, located right here on the green in South Royalton. Solar Fest, they're going to be helping out actually at Saturday's Imagine Zero, and we'll probably get some more details on their two-day festival returning in Brandon, Vermont next summer, 2025. The White River Land Collaborative, they're in the midst of a raffle right now. We'll try to get information out to you about that. And a breakfast and lunch spot in Randolph called Wit and Grit. Back with you shortly here on Green Zine. Good morning, Henry. Are you familiar with that little instrumental piece of music?
I am. I like that.
You like that?
Galliards from early music. My Dorothy Swayze's family were all into early music, and so I had that when I was in my teenage years, hearing things earlier than Baroque, medieval and earlier than that. That's probably Renaissance music.
Yeah, you know, and that definitely is informed by that period. That album that we just played, Little Martha, from came out in 1972. That is the mellowest piece on the album. It is the Allman Brothers Band out of Macon, Georgia, from the album aptly titled Eat a Peach.
Yes, that's in the mood for both the season and for the mood of that kind of music.
Yeah, and you know, I haven't talked to a lot of, you know, individual gardeners, but my sense is that as far as gardening for both vegetables and fruit, pretty darn good year, 2024. Is that what you're hearing, Henry?
The apple harvest, I think, both statewide and in Jane's backyard is outrageous.
In a good way.
Making up for many lost years. Yes.
Yeah, last year with that late frost was devastating to orchardists around the state, but not this year. Yeah, everything's brimming over.
Yeah, I think it's a bumper crop even against good years in the past. I think it's a good bright spot in the damage done by climate change to so many other sectors of the farming community this year, mostly due to flooding, or drought. But
In fact, I think you've selected a piece that we're going to be playing during the course of the show about the impacts of flooding.
Yes, we're hopping around doing quite a few things in today's show. There's really a lot of action to follow, and certainly flooding and climate change is not abating. It's on the way up and getting worse and worse. And then we look at some things that are happening that are on the green side of things, and ways to weigh in and help move the process forward. I think this is needs to be an all hands on deck kind of approach to not just standing by and seeing what other people are doing, but do it. Get engaged with some piece of it yourself.
Yep.
That's my continuing message. And when you're talking to regulators and corporations and policymakers, I think it's, you know, just simple. It's demand change. We've got to fix the climate problem.
Yep.
And it makes, and so many of those fixes make our lives better. It isn't just about changing warming. It's about having a kinder and less fuss and muss in your life. So, anyway, onward.
Onward. I'm looking at what's the name of this critter here? Sparky. Sparky's looking at me. A different looking a budgerigger, a type of parrot. I'm not familiar with the budgerigger, but Sparky's pretty.
No, I'm not either.
Pretty
not,
handsome guy.
But it's pretty interesting. You start looking at animals and communication, and you know, we think we're the only ones can talk, but this little bird note thing is all about birds that not only can say human words, but actually figure things out. No, you know, I mean, one of these has a bird that can contemplate what zero is, which
wow.
is tough even for a grade school kid. You get a young first, second, it gets to third or fourth grade at least before kids can understand the concept of nothing,
right?
Something that isn't there.
But before they're capable of imagining zero, yeah.
yes. I mean, just their brains haven't yet figured out how to digest that kind of abstraction.
Right. Well, why don't we go to Sparky and see what's up with him, the Sparky, the famous talking budgerigger. And then we might link that. We'll talk a little bit about that afterwards, but we might link it with a little story I have about the boreal toad. So we'll start with some critters here on Green Zine.
Excellent.
And then we'll probably, we won't go to the dark side too much today, but here's Bird Note. You're listening to Green Zine on Royalton Community Radio.
This is Bird Note. This is the call of a goose. Or is it? Actually, it's Darvin Gebhardt demonstrating his championship goose calling technique. But there are also birds that use human language. Talking birds have varying degrees of intelligence and speaking ability. Some, like the crow, are able to mimic only a few words and phrases, while some budgerigars, parakeets on this side of the pond, have a vocabulary of over 1,000 words. Sparky Williams was a famous budgie that lived in England in the 1950s. For 6 years, he worked as a character actor on British radio and retired a wealthy bird.
They call me Pretty Sparky. I'm just a little bird, but I can talk and chatter all the day. I'm a clever little budgie, aren't I? Was that nice?
Alex, the African grey parrot, was another notable talking bird. Alex had a limited vocabulary, about 150 words, but he was famous for his cognitive abilities. He could recognize colors and shapes, and also use the word none to describe the absence of quantity. In other words, he grasped the concept of zero.
What's here?
Truck.
That's good boy, truck. Good parrot. How many?
Two.
That's right. Good boy.
Want a nut?
Well, you can have a nut. Go choose your own.
Scientists continue to debate whether any other species can truly learn human language. But birds like Sparky and Alex could certainly hold up their side of the conversation. For Bird Note, I'm Mary McCann.
Wow, budgerigar. Now I know how to pronounce it, Henry.
Well, you did pretty well. If she hadn't corrected you, I never would have.
I'm always willing to be corrected, and now I'm trying to think of songs that could rhyme with that, and I came up with one. Cigar and budgerigar definitely rhyme with each other. No smoking allowed in the studio, though. No.
I wondered if it was a talking cigar.
Talking cigar. There we go. Yeah, really, really good. I like that.
All right. So, what you got there in the toad and frog world?
I am looking for my toad story, and I'm not really finding it at the moment. So we may have to wait on the toad. I saved a lot of windows here. It was from Orion. I'll be able to pick it up later, maybe during one of our taped pieces here.
Okay.
So, yeah, we should just give people a heads up. We're going to talk about some EV charging activity happening up in Burlington. We'll also talk a little more about the Imagine Zero Music Festival on Saturday. And, Henry, I know you've got some recent reports coming in, and there's a story. Actually, you mentioned to me offline that maybe we should give an update on a story that is in the 7 Days. I'm getting it here because it mentions, well, it mentions a very important subject, and that is about the modeling that is used by the state to track climate change and how we're doing on our goals over the years of reaching minimizing greenhouse gas emissions. And quoted in here extensively is Ilana Mihaly, who is the vice president. We had her on the air, what, about a month ago, Henry? Something like that.
Yeah, I would think so.
Yeah, the Conservation Law Foundation. And she, her comments about this being not very accurate, the way that the ANR is measuring greenhouse gas emissions and assuring legislators that Vermont is on track to meet its goals of the Global Solutions Warming Act, which our Global Warming Solutions Act, I guess, is the proper order of that. That bill was passed back in 2020 over the veto of then and still Governor Phil Scott. And part of that act had a suit mechanism so that if an entity, an individual, a nonprofit, an environmental activist group felt like the state wasn't meeting its commitments, that the state could be sued. And the CLF did indicate to the state back in late July that they were preparing to sue unless they got an answer in the next 60 days, which would be at the end of September. So this article, just for folks who want to read the entire thing, is in the current issue of 7 Days, just came out yesterday. On page 15, and the title of the article, and actually, this is funny, Henry, in the course of this article, and also the guy that wrote it, we pretty much have had them all on Green Zine. But we've been here for 10 or 11 years, so we've had a lot of guests. Cooking the Books, that's the title. Cooking the Books, environmentalists say Vermont is exaggerating its progress in reducing greenhouse gas emissions. And a couple of people, most notably Jared Duvall of the Energy Action Network and also Ben Edgerly of another nonprofit, are saying, and Ilana Mihaly, who we interviewed here a month ago, also agreed, these are just not minor discrepancies. In fact, I looked at some of the graphs that are in this story, and they're off by a good 15 to 20%. Pretty significant. And I don't know where it's all going to lead, but I just thought I'd point that out to listeners as a follow-up.
Yeah, just to remind people of the overview, what happened was that the Agency of Natural Resources was in charge of coming up with the figures of how we're doing on meeting our climate goals. And they chose to use a report, which they already had and was kind of convenient to use, that the report says right in it that it's for comparing one kind of improvement in emissions over another, and not to be used as a guide for how we're actually doing. And the lawsuit that our guest filed said, hey, the state has better numbers than this, and you aren't using them. You're using the wrong numbers. And I believe that the Agency of Natural Resources, because of that suit, or maybe would have anyway, but they weren't doing it very fast, has attempted to come up with a new set of numbers, and they hired a consulting firm to put those numbers together. And I think that's what this, I haven't read the 7 days article, but I suspect that's what it's, and it's all about, you know, truth in advertising. It is saying things like it is rather than greenwashing things. And I don't know that the Agency of Natural Resources were purposefully greenwashing, but it was convenient to go with the figures they had. And we have to be at a higher standard. And on that very same subject, for kind of a worldwide look, in our links, there is a link to the EU, the European Union, and they are holding airlines accountable for reporting on not only their CO2 emissions when they fly those jets that carry us around the world in great numbers, but they also are now having to report on their other materials that are in their contrails, in their high-altitude combustion. And so there are nitrous oxides and there's carbon particles. And some researchers think that this has more than doubling the effect of the CO2 emissions that they make in terms of warming. And the EUs are holding airlines accountable for reporting those. They isn't going to be fully informed until 2027. So there's a link to that article in our notes. And I believe that in some situations, there is carbon limiting, you know, carbon laws saying that you can't go above a certain standard of emission, and when you do, you pay a price for it. And that price currently for an international flight, U.S. to Europe and back again, a round trip, is about 70 euros. So that will probably land up showing up in a ticket price before we're done. And I think that currently when we fly an airplane, we have no idea the costs that we are putting on society. We just know what we paid the airline. And I think that having a price in that ticket price is really important. And my guess is that that 70 euros is really just scratching the top of the anthill, and the angry ants haven't yet really been counted.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if there'll be angry flyers out there, but so that we'll call it a surcharge or a penalty or whatever you want to call it. Is that going to be assessed against the airline per passenger mile, or is that directly going to affect the, is that just being passed along by the individual airline to the passenger, the customer who's buying the ticket?
No, I don't know. The devil's in the detail, and I haven't mined all the details, but I believe it's an industry charge.
Okay.
And there's a whole thing in Europe that's going on that the U.S. should get on board with, because it would actually be financially benefit to the U.S. to be on board with it.
Oh, yeah.
And that is the carbon border adjustment. And so when things in the European Union, or things move in and out of the European Union, they calculate the carbon footprint of the thing that went in or out. And they look at that carbon footprint in terms of whether the thing was produced efficiently or inefficiently. And when it was produced inefficiently, with lots of carbon emissions and not recapturing energy, and it's all based on carbon, not on whether you're using up natural resources. But when those things move, they get taxed for the movement of that carbon across the border, for basically shipping carbon emissions into another country. And and the U.S. happens to be a pretty clean producer of what we produce. Our steel and heavy materials are produced efficiently. And so the steel from China would probably, if traded for steel from the U.S., we would probably get the carbon border adjustments would put money in our pocket.
We would benefit.
It would benefit. And then it forces the Chinese to, you know, stop burning so much coal and make their steel with renewable electricity, which a lot of U.S. steel production is now done with electric furnaces.
So I want to go to something that's not so efficient, that's produced in the U.S. We'll pull out the Hummer. I think they're still making those Hummers, which use a lot of fuel. They use a whole lot of fuel. They're really big. I don't know if you're allowed, if you are a citizen of the European Union, I don't know if you're allowed to buy one of those, whether General Motors is actually selling them over there. But would that type of vehicle then be affected by this? I mean, if it was being shipped over there, hey, here's this thing that instead of getting...
It isn't what it burns. That has to do with the fuel company that's selling you the fuel.
It's how it's produced.
It's about how it's produced.
Okay.
So if it's produced in a super efficient factory, the fact that it produced a monster doesn't make any difference.
Okay, well, Frankenstein lives. Let's shift gears, because as you said, we have a lot on our plate in this environmental magazine, which we call Green Zine. This is a little bit out of season, but for those of you looking forward to not only fall and winter, but also to spring, particularly vernal pool part of spring, I pulled this from the summer edition of Orion Magazine. The fall one just came out, but it's currently being read by someone else, and we will get to that in a future week. But let me just read. This is pretty brief, and it's about boreal frogs. Long before you encounter one clambering across the trail, before you're tempted to catch it with both hands and gently trace that thin, pale line down their knobbly back, you might meet a boreal toad. Anaxrus boreas, in a different form, in a fleeting place. Head for a low bench or valley bottom in spring. Aim for the trees and look for a clearing. Peering into the shallows between starwort and sedge, you may find long, slick strings of tiny black toad eggs decorating the rim of a vernal pool. Ephemeral wetlands like these are a welcome breeding ground for amphibians, essential incubators for the developing eggs and larvae, safe from the mouths of hungry fish. A few weeks later, if you're lucky, you'll be greeted by a riot of tadpoles, smaller and darker than their froggy allies, and lacking the salamander's frilled external gills. They zip and zoom, waiting to grow lungs and legs. As yet unburdened by their kind's dwindling numbers, they cannot know their clade's vulnerability, cannot know if their metamorphosis will end before their first home evaporates. For now, their world is small. So next May, go into the woods, look for the light flashing on low water, see how the spruce and fir seem to nod above, as if leaning in, as if peering down into a cradle, eager to welcome the prize, pause, this wink of possibility. All about the boreal frog. The boreal toad. Do not mistake a toad for a frog. It's easy to do.
Yeah, they're all hoppy things.
They're all hoppy things. Yeah, we have a toad. I'm definitely sure it's a toad. He's very, very dark, almost black, and he's very small, but he lives. He doesn't need to be near water. He's kind of under one of our flagstone steps, and every time I head over there, I just make sure that he's in a safe spot and I don't step on him.
So frogs generally are moist to wet on the outside, and toads are frequently quite dry.
Yes.
And the toads tend to be horny skins. They tend to have rough skins, and frogs are slippery, and when you catch them, they jump out of your through your fingers.
Yeah, well, the word used in this little article is knobbly. They have very knobbly skin.
Yeah, knobbly. There we go. Yes, that's fair game. Yeah, so, yeah, paying attention to nature is really centering. There was a bird note that I seriously considered putting on today, which was about just how an urban person can enjoy birds, even with all the traffic noise and seemingly no birds around. If you just open up your senses and listen, there are birds almost everywhere. Right. And you can check them out between your car parked in the parking lot to the supermarket, because they're there. And in Vermont, they're really there. But I thought it was such an urban thing that I didn't choose it for today. Maybe we should move on. We got a lot of stuff there's kind of a grand overview piece from Vermont Public from Abigail Giles. The link I put up for it is from New Hampshire, because it was a link that took you directly to the soundtrack, and the Vermont one made you look it up. But it's a recent link, and it just puts in perspective what's really happening, affecting Vermonters with climate change. And I think it's good to put this in perspective rather than just being bombarded by it.
Yeah.
So let's look at flooding.
I do have the link in front of me. The one concern I have, Henry, so be ready with your next subject, is when I hover over the listen button, it kind of is going dim. But we're going to give it a try and see if it comes on. And I think
Vermont has a reputation for being a place that is relatively safe from the worst impacts of climate change. But as Vermont Public's Abigail Giles reports, the latest series of climate-fueled flooding disasters is prompting some to wonder whether that's the case.
On a single day in late July, a pretty normal-looking summer storm dropped a record 8 inches of rain over the Northeast Kingdom in just 24 hours. Rivers and brooks swelled rapidly and jumped their banks. Homes that sat in the same place for hundreds of years were swept away. Jeff Coro is the fire chief in Lindenville. He's been a firefighter there for 34 years.
And this is an event that we never had before to this degree. So we're venturing down a road that we haven't been on, and it's not a good road to be on.
It was the fifth time in 13 months the town saw flooding, and the second time in July. And Lindenville wasn't alone. Other Vermont towns were flooded more than three times in the last year. Washington County, home to the state's capital, is tied for being the second most disaster-prone county in America. That's if you count the number of federal disaster declarations from 2011 through 2023. And this kind of heavy rainfall, it's something the Northeast is seeing more of because of human-caused climate change. Jonathan Winter is a professor at Dartmouth College who studies this. His research finds the Northeast now sees 50% more extreme precipitation than it did before 1995. As the atmosphere warms, it can hold more moisture, and that means more rain. So far, it seems in New England,
we're getting the same storms, they just have more fuel to work with once they get here.
It's a trend Winter says will likely continue as the climate warms, but could be made much better if the world cuts greenhouse gas emissions. Still, it's come as an unpleasant surprise for some. John Wagner co-owns Bare Roots Farm in Williamstown and Barrie, where he grows organic vegetables. Wagner used to farm on Long Island, but that ended after his fields were inundated there with salt water during Superstorm Sandy. He says the vegetables turned black overnight.
So we decided to move up to Vermont, a landlocked place where theoretically you couldn't flood. but turns out you can.
After nearly a decade of drought, something else Vermont is seeing more of with climate change, a flash flood and sustained wet weather swept away about 75% of their harvest last summer.
We basically came into the season on credit card debt. So we're still kind of like, you know, a week at a time trying to just stay afloat.
This year, they're growing everything they can up on higher ground.
We've got a big field of winter squash, pumpkins in here. So we've got a sweet dumpling there, heirloom varieties.
But in some places, higher ground brings its own hazards in a changing climate. Up high in the Green Mountains in Ripton, there's growing concern about landslides wiping out their mostly dirt roads. Last summer, during a torrential rainstorm, a hillside collapsed in the night, sweeping an entire home off of its foundation before the owner's eyes.
Landslides were not really a thing up here.
Lori Cox is chair of the Ripton Select Board.
All of that makes one realize that everything that you thought was solid under your feet isn't always solid. Yeah.
But with entire 200-plus-year-old communities located in places that now flood, these are not the only changes the state will be forced to contemplate in the coming decades. Back in Williamstown, farmer John Wagner says he's grateful Vermont has water and doesn't have to contend with sea level rise. Still, he says he doesn't think of any place as safe from climate change.
I mean, I think ultimately it is affecting everyone everywhere.
Wagner says he's determined to adapt. For Vermont Public, I'm Abigail Giles in Williamstown.
Yeah, very good piece. A lot of that, I think I had read about what had happened up there in above St. Johnsbury, but I wasn't aware of the Ripton connection there, Henry, the landslides over there.
Yeah, and she didn't cover all the places in the state that got flooded. She just did a selection.
Yeah.
It's basically, I went and visited my glider, walked in and tried to got a support rope around the tail of my glider, still hanging up in a tree 30 feet off the ground, trying to stabilize it.
Mm-hmm.
And I was on steep ground in heavily wooded area and was climbing, and I was climbing up the slope, and there were piles of leaf debris piled up from heavy rainstorm having washed them downstream and in some places on the road coming in. That was a very shallow grade. It had stripped all the grass out of that road and was down to the rocks that road was made of.
Wow.
And that all happened sometime in the last 3 weeks. And I had been watching the weather, wondering if my plane was going to get blown out of the tree before I got a chance to let it down gently.
Yeah.
And there were two thunderstorm cells that went through there, and obviously they dumped a lot of rain. So we're just getting much bigger events. And the key to holding that water on the land is increasing the organic matter in the soil. A 1% increase in organic matter will hold almost an extra inch of rainfall. So if you could increase the organic matter by, say, 4 inches, these new 5 and 6 inch rainfalls wouldn't do the damage they're doing now.
Mm.
And this is both on the hillsides, and it's also in farmland. The same thing happens when there is one of these big weather dumps. When I'm up out on the Lamoille or the Winooski River, it just runs brown with dirt coming off the landscape going into lake. And it takes a week or 2 weeks for that water to clear. It's just an enormous load of soil coming off of the land, getting washed away because of. And I'm sure that when Vermont was back in the primeval forest days, when there was a very modest indigenous population here, being a little more careful of the land before the Europeans came along and decided they wanted to harvest it all and make room for farming. Mm. I'm sure that runoff didn't exist. And when we stripped off the vegetation to get to that nice forest soil and grow things in it, we just destroyed that soil and let it wash downhill. Mm. And that's part of why, but the trees and natural processes are rebuilding that, and we need to encourage them to do it as fast as possible.
Yeah, you know, while we're on the weather front, let's go to a totally different place that has a totally different set of environmental catastrophic issues going on, and that is out in the Pacific Southwest. I'm going to play a little music to lead us out towards this the largest city in the Southwest. Here's a song written by Jimmy Webb, but performed here by Roger Miller, and you'll figure out when we get to the story why I'm playing it.
By the time I get to Phoenix, she'll be rising. She'll find the note I left hanging on her door. She'll laugh when she reads the part that says I'm leaving, 'cause I've left that girl so many times before.
Yeah, the classic by Jimmy Webb. Of course, most people know the Glenn Campbell version. Well, I don't know whether he wants to get to Phoenix or get out of Phoenix. Henry, they are up to today marks the 102nd straight day of 100-plus degrees temperatures in the southwest city of Phoenix, breaking their all-time record, and it looks like this week's forecast is calling for more. So they're not just going to barely break it, they're going to shatter the effort. And of course, we know those are very difficult conditions to live in for both people and wildlife. And as far as plants and amount of water left in the groundwater, serious issues going on in the states of Utah, Nevada, Arizona, and New Mexico. But I knew there was a heat wave going on. I didn't know the first day that they went above 100 degrees was on May 27th. They've been above 100 since May 27th, every day.
Yes. Happy spring.
Yep. I don't know. It is kind of humorous. We're not living out there. But rather than people, you know, we do get climate migrants here in Vermont that are coming from other places. I know some people that came here from Texas for various reasons, not only climate reasons, but also political reasons. But I don't think Phoenix is experiencing a loss of population. I think it is still growing there.
Yeah. Yeah, I think, you know, if you're affluent, you just start living inside with air conditionings and come out in the evening or early morning when it's civilized outside and disappear into your air conditioned world, which is
in the bubble.
You know, it doesn't work very well for the bottom. Probably third of the world's population. They're just getting scraped off by climate change. Okay, so let me just make a bridge from that flooding to we talked about the upping the organic matter in the soil, and there is a new energy plant that is has been applied for fast track to in 30 days go from having submit a permit to being able to build a really rocket fast solution. And And it is a very interesting plant, and something that I used to be on a listserv for producer gas, it was called, and for many years read that thread. And if you take any kind of carbaceous materials, wood fiber, whatever, and you put them in a sealed container without oxygen, and you heat them up, they go from a reaction that takes heat from the outside to a reaction that generates its own heat, and it produces gas, and that gas coming off has all kinds of things in it. And in Japan, they use that to produce vinegar, but it also will produce the equivalent of methane, which you then can burn in a generator and generate electricity. And a byproduct of this process can be biochar. And so this Lindenville plant that is on fast track to be built is a pilot project to test this out in the state of Vermont. And then if it in fact passes muster, with Lindenville being the guinea pig for it, and they've gotten flooded, they're part of that flooded in twice in a month scenario, and also got themselves, the whole Northeast Kingdom is just sort of a playground for things that went wrong. The whole attempt to bring in manufacturing. And,
yeah, EB5. So yeah, the big scam that the government was asleep about. Yeah, that one.
Yep. Yeah. So they've sort of gotten themselves made into mincemeat by trying to save themselves in ways that didn't work out, and so the question is this plant actually a good idea or is it a bad idea? And I guess I don't know the answer to that.
Oh.
And I don't really have an opinion at the moment. It could be a very good idea, but what's disturbing is that it's being fast-tracked without evaluating any of the side effects of it. They aren't looking at, where do you get this biomass from? Yes, they've listed where it's going to come from, but what does that do to runoff from those hills that it's coming off of?
Right.
Does it make no difference, or does it actually make the runoff worse? What happens to the things you didn't make use of completely that are coming out of the plant, the particulate matter or the is unlocking all kinds of nasty chemistry that it's basically like being near an oil refinery. You're manufacturing out of natural materials something very much like what the petroleum industry does with oil that's come out of the ground when they run it through a fracking facility. And we know that the people who live around those plants, even with their scrubbers and everything else, have terrible rates of cancer and all sorts of things. And so, you know, is that being taken care of? And so anyway, that's a concern, and it's something that I'm working with one of the environmental organizations to try to at least get them to slow down long enough to evaluate whether those bases have been covered or whether it was a simple, hey, this is deemed green energy because it is it's a renewable product that's coming off the land, and whether it's good or bad, short-term or long-term isn't really being looked at. Yeah. And if anyone's interested in getting involved in that and weighing in on it, doing some of the research, you know, they should contact me, henrysuasey@gmail.com, or 6-6-7.
I think it goes 6-6-7.
8-9-3-2.
There, we got it. I don't know why I remembered that part.
You got it. Yeah, you only see my incoming phone calls all the time.
Yeah, I guess that's
anyway,
it.
So I'm going to reach out to the Vermont Healthy Soils Coalition and see if anyone wants to get in. But it's a 30-day process, and the clock is ticking, so whatever's going to happen, it's got to happen in the next week or two, or else it's probably water over the dam, and we'll have to fight it in the courts later on if we don't like it.
You know, your description of not being required to look into what I will call future externalities, things that could happen, and actually with enough science out there over the last several decades, these are not mystery repercussions down the road. They could be tracked ahead of time before any ground is broken or any emissions are made, et cetera. It reminded me of, I don't know if we spoke to her directly, but we played a piece from a woman who's kind of the minister of environmental sort of watchdogism or equality in Wales, and how
right, the minister of the future.
Minister of the future, that's right. And that's her job, to sit down with corporations and with government officials and run everything through long before the project ever gets greenlighted. And I don't know why that can't happen here in Vermont. I don't know why this is an exception. But
I think her job is the only one in the world like
it
that.
It is.
It needs to happen everywhere. I mean, that's craziness. And she's blocking it if they haven't considered those things.
Right.
She isn't making them prove it in court or anything. She isn't making it so progress can't happen. She's just saying, did you really consider this? She's just checking off the boxes to see if they've at least considered where it's going. And we grab hold of an idea, and humans are really good at chasing down threads and dealing with the detail, but she forces people to back up and look at it in a more holistic way and make them at least consider if they have done that. And if they haven't considered it, or
back to the drawing board.
do it and then come back.
Yeah, right. Don't necessarily give up, but make sure your metrics are accurate and you're coming up with real objective information. Maybe the project will happen in a much a kinder, more climate friendly way. Hey, Henry, I'm looking at a page here from the Imagine Zero Festival, which is coming up, and it's all about music, but it has a heavy sustainability environmental credo. And I'm just going to, and they actually have a little graph at there. I don't often go to look up a music festival or concert and see a lot of data about the environment on the homepage of, usually see all the musicians who are going to be there, the time they're going to play, how much tickets cost, etc. But here's the Imagine Zero's festival mission statement. I'll just shorten it to IZ. IZ's mission is to have a festival that is zero carbon and zero waste. That means having the show entirely powered by renewable energy and have no trash. We know it's unlikely to get all the way there for now, so they're being realistic. This is not going to be a perfect festival that way, but we think it's worth a try. Worth a shot to try and see how close they can get. Here is a breakdown of the carbon footprint of a tour, credit to carboncredits.com, and on the pages that follow, you'll find more of the initiatives we are putting to get there in each key area. So for the festival, in average, the distance traveled by the musicians and those attending account for 33% of the carbon impact. The venue, the power that is used at the venue, mostly from traditional grid-supplied power, is 34%. Putting people up at hotels and getting them around is 10%. Merchandise production is essentially 12%, and the travel of the band is 9%. Now, I think Ben Cogan, one of the co-founders of this festival, would readily admit that the biggest carbon impact last year, it had to be right near the top, is their headlining band flew from California to Boston. and back again at the expense of the festival. But think about the the carbon footprint of that. So they are encouraging people to use a shuttle out of, you can catch a shuttle coming up Woodstock. All this is at the website where you can get on along that route. You can ride your bike out there. You can carpool. So as far as commuting there, and of course, they really are trying not to generate any trash. So once again, someone doing the numbers and then trying to at least get closer to a best number, which of course, as we started the show talking about zero, Henry.
Yeah, and there's a tremendous value in doing extreme behavior like that. It's like years ago on the show, we had someone from who had been a Dartmouth professor who lived in our area, forgotten where, Vershire or someplace.
Oh, I know who you're talking about. Yeah,
yeah.
He lives up in Belfast, Maine now. Yeah.
Yeah, Belfast, Maine. I'm spacing his name. But he was living, trying to live a zero footprint life, and he biked everywhere.
Yeah,
he didn't ever take a car, and what you learn from those people who, and from yourself doing an experiment, see if you can reduce the trash leaving your house to less than a pound a month or something crazy like that. It's very hard to do because everything comes wrapped in things and so forth. And what you learn from doing that is you get inventive and you come up with other solutions. There's a steep learning curve as to what we're doing wrong when you take on one of those kind of extreme approaches to things, to learn from it. And our previous guest that I was describing, he was looking at the whole world footprint and dividing it up by on a per person basis. And we in the United States just go through so much material and energy compared to the world as an average, maybe 100 times the world average. And it isn't that we should be down at the world average, but we should learn what's wasteful and what actually improves our quality of life. It's just stupid to be wasteful because it's convenient.
And Henry, my in-studio crack researcher just handed me this information. So the person we're talking about, and we're actually hoping to meet him, he's good friends with friends of ours. His name is Jim Merkel, M-E-R-K-E-L, and the book, and we should revisit Jim's perspectives on the environment. As I said, I'm pretty sure he lives up in Belfast, Maine, continues to do sustainable work up there, and the book that he put out a number of years ago is called Radical Simplicity. Radical Simplicity, yeah, yeah. Small footprints on a, I can't read the rest of the title, and that book is still available. So I will do my best to get a hold of Jim Merkel, as a returning guest, because he was very early on. He might have been year one or year two, and he was sort of the major domo of environmental not activism, behavior, but consulting at Dartmouth for a number of years.
Yeah.
And be great to catch up with Jim. So we're down to about 6 minutes, and I'm going to play a little bit of music at the end, but back to you, Henry.
Yeah, I have one more thing on the list. It's in the notes, and that is that I've talked about getting out there and doing something to get out the vote, and saying that that's something we can do that really will influence how climate is tackled. There is a Volt podcast that I've put a link into or in for that gets into a really fascinating discussion. That there are people who consistently list climate as their first concern in who they would vote for.
Hmm.
And yet those people who are very passionate about it and keep, you know, answering that that is their top priority, that a lot of them are very intermittent voters.
Oh.
That they'll vote one year and they won't vote another, or the year after, and then they'll vote again. And they just don't get around to getting the polls. And the podcast points out that two things happen. One is you don't get the people elected who are going to do something about climate. But number two, the politicians who are in Washington will look at the polls that they put out to find out what the hot issues are. And they only look about that with voters who vote.
Yes.
Because those are the people who are going to put them back in office the next go around.
Right.
And so from a practical point of view, that's who they care, who they want to satisfy if they want to get reelected. And consequently, if you could get these people who have climate at the top of their agenda to be actually voting regularly, then the politicians start to realize which issues are important and start putting more of their political capital into voting. And basically, if you go to that podcast, there is that group can find out from the polls. They have done nothing about issues and everything just about number crunching to find out who people are and how to get them to the polls. And they're looking for volunteers to help people get those people to the polls. And they have well-documented methods of doing it. And it's really about just waking them up and getting to make a commitment to go to the poll and make sure that they actually did it.
Yeah.
So,
and, you know, I'm wondering, you know, people get frustrated, climate activists and environmentalists, and they might literally be going off the political grid. But yeah, definitely something worth checking out. Underneath us right now, a group of sisters, the Wolf Sisters, they're going to be performing at the Imagine Zero Music Festival on Saturday. All the information is at Imagine Zero. Come on out and support the environment and support local music. And we still have a little bit of time, but I'm going to acknowledge our underwriters once again. We couldn't do this without the generous support of such great groups as Soliflect, Bale, Royal Trail Works, Daniel Leibowitz, the Upper Pass Beer Company, First Branch Coffee Company, Solar Fest, White River Land Collaborative, Wit and Grit. And I know that, I don't know if they're an underwriter, I don't think they are, but I know that Norwich Solar is one of the key sponsors of Imagine Zero, as is Revision Energy, which is a solar company that originally started in Maine, but now has offices in both New Hampshire and Vermont. So it's going to be a great educational as well as a great musical day. And do I have anything else? I probably do, but we won't get to it. I'm just going to give some advice once again to support good journalism. And if you were just to search for Climate Forward New York Times, you may not have to necessarily do the whole thing about getting the New York Times, but a very valuable resource, the New York Times Climate Forward section. And Henry, I know you depend on a publication out of Yale for some of the information that you bring to the show.
Yes, yes. Yale 350. I'm on their mailing list, so I have that on my screen all the time. And there's Canary Media as well as another name I pull material from. And we do have, I guess, a minute more to go that I can talk if I'm right. And EV chargers are being rolled out in Vermont. Burlington's doing 200 of them, five times increase over what's here. A lot of federal money in there, but it's happening all across the state. And EV batteries, there's a new battery production plant that's doing sodium batteries that charge faster. They aren't lighter, but they charge faster, and they're much, 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 much cheaper.
Wow.
So things are moving.
Let's find out more about that. Here's three names, Henry. I'll email them to you. Kurt Mayland, Jim Merkel, and I think we need a return visit from our friend Gus Speth. I'm going to bring up Dark River here from the Wolf Sisters. Thanks for joining us. See you next week, Henry.
See you next week. Bye-bye.